Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on June 22, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Knox versus SEIU, the union dues case decided just yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we have two guest speakers, Mr. W. James Young and Mr. Dominic Perella. Each will speak for some 8 to 10 minutes, after which we'll have some discussion and then questions from the audience. W. James Young is a staff attorney at National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Most importantly for our purposes today, he's counsel of record for the case we're going to be discussing. Dominic Perella is a partner at the Hogan Lovells Law Firm, where he concentrates his practice on, among other things, appellate and Supreme Court litigation. He served as a judicial clerk to the Honorable Sandra L. Lynch on the First Circuit. Their bios were provided to you in a notice of this call, so I'm not going to introduce them any further. And with that, Mr. Young, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. Knox versus SEIU Local 1000 started in 2005 when Governor Schwarzenegger proposed four ballot initiatives to put before the voters regarding the continuing budgetary problems being suffered by the state of California. Unions throughout the state, particularly public sector unions, opposed those ballot initiatives, and a number of them, including SEIU Local 1000, which represents approximately 100,000 state employees, imposed special assessments or dues increases in order to fund their opposition to Governor Schwarzenegger's initiatives on the November 2005 ballot. The SEIU Local 1000 also provides an annual notice called a Hudson Notice, pursuant to a Supreme Court decision of the same name from 1986, and had sent a notice to the approximately 36,000 to 38,000 non-members in June of 2005. The governor made his proposal in July, and at the end of July, SEIU Local 1000 proposed and passed at the end of August a temporary special assessment to create a political fight-back fund, stating that the monies raised, approximately $12 million from both members and non-members, would be utilized for purposes of fighting these ballot initiatives and electing legislators and a governor more conducive to the union's institutional interests. The union specifically disclaimed that any amount of the fund would be utilized for purposes other than the normal purposes for which agency fees, or as we prefer to refer them, forced union dues, were utilized. Eight non-members who were seven non-members and one member who resigned over the special assessment filed suit on November 1st, 2005 in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of California, and alleging that the union's temporary special assessment violated their First and 14th Amendment rights to be free from coerced support of political speech. The district court, Judge Morrison C. England, initially issued a temporary restraining order, which was subsequently lifted in two days later, and the case proceeded through the district court discovery. Ultimately, Judge England entered judgment in 2008 in favor of the non-members, finding that, in fact, SEIU had violated their constitutional rights and that they were entitled to a new notice and a refund of fees that were used for political purposes if they objected, plus nominal damages. The union appealed this ruling to the Ninth Circuit, which ruled in December 2010, Reversed Judge England and held that the union's temporary special assessment was perfectly acceptable under the notice that had been issued prior to the adoption of the assessment, balancing the constitutional rights of the non-members against the monetary interests of the union, and finding the notice to have been a reasonable accommodation of the non-members' constitutional rights. The petition for certiorari was filed in due course. At the end of June 2011, the United States Supreme Court granted cert, and the case was heard on January 10th of this year. Of course, the decision was issued last year. It is a substantial victory, to our view, for the rights of non-members against coerced union speech. In fact, the latest in a series of cases brought by foundation attorneys over the years. I believe this was our 15th appearance before the Supreme Court. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of the court, and in his opinion, which was joined by four other justices, Justices Kennedy, Chief Justice, and Justice Thomas. Ruled that the union's actions in this case were, and I quote, indefensible. The court went through the procedures and, as well as noting a 11th hour or 11th hour and 59th minute union effort to moot the case by providing the opportunity for refunds to the class members. And rejected the notion that the union could unilaterally divest the court of its jurisdiction, and to unilaterally the manner in which it advertises the availability of its refund. The opinion is significant, and is a complete victory for the petitioners in this case, the non-members. The court was explicit, we believe, in addressing the issue from the appropriate perspective, that is, applying strict scrutiny to schemes for coerced speech. It's the traditional test, but it's one that the union argued in this case has been less clear in the union dues cases that have reached the court. The court also significantly, to our view, addresses the issue of a longstanding, what it calls, anomaly in the law that the non-members' dissent is not to be presumed, a phrase that first appeared in a case in which both union members and non-members were the litigants, a case called Machinist versus Street from, I believe, 1961, and held that in this case, non-members, for the special assessment, non-members can't be required to simply opt out. They have to opt in and give their affirmative consent to union political speech. This is a position that was argued strenuously by one of our amicus, Deborah Lefetra from the Pacific Legal Foundation, was the primary author of that brief, which was joined by Mountain States Legal Foundation, the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, and the Cato Institute. And it is a longstanding effort that we have made over the years with, frankly, not much success. The court could have addressed the issue in a case called Davenport versus Washington Education Association in 2005, chose not to. And as one commentator put it, the whole notion of dissent is not to be presumed as it relates to non-members really doesn't make much sense. Dahlia Lithwick at Slate Magazine said, compared it to that cute girl in your Russian literature class who won't go out with you. Chances are she doesn't want to have a more intimate relationship with you either. And certainly that logic is equally applicable to non-members who have chosen not to, notwithstanding substantial incentives chosen not to associate with the union that serves as their monopoly bargaining representative. And so this is a substantial advance in the law. The court's decision the judgment was joined by Justices Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg, and Justice Breyer and Justice 16. I think I stuck to your time limits there.
Terrific. Mr. Dominic Perella, you want to give us your remarks?
Sure, thanks. Let me say at the outset, I in fact worked with Jim Young on this case, but I've been asked for purposes of this call to provide something of a devil's advocate view. So let me do my best to disassociate myself from our previous positions on this and do that for you. It's interesting, if you read the dissenting opinion in this case, the dissenting opinion doesn't exactly come out and defend the idea of an opt-out regime as sort of on first principles. Instead, it talks about the departure from precedent that happened in this case. And I think the dissent has, for purposes of my current devil's advocate position, a good case. There have been a number of cases over the years in which the Supreme Court has either held or suggested that the way to protect non-members from being forced to subsidize union speech is to give them the opportunity to opt out, is to have the union say at the beginning of the year, here's the amount of money we're going to charge non-members. If you would like to not be charged for any political or other non-collective bargaining related activities that we're going to engage in, let us know now, and you won't be charged. That regime has been accepted by the court for decades. And the opinion in this case, the majority opinion by Justice Alito, purports to limit itself to the situation presented in this case, which was a mid-year special assessment, as Jim mentioned. But the language of the case is much broader. Justice Alito pretty explicitly hints that the court is willing to consider an opt-in regime, in other words, assuming that all non-members will pay nothing in terms of non-chargeable activities that the union engages in unless they affirmatively consent to do so. And the Alito opinion broadly suggests that the court's willing to consider changing the law and making such a regime applicable for all union dues, not just for mid-year special assessments. And not only that, but the Alito opinion also, just with respect to special assessments and mid-year dues increases, says, and I quote, that unions may not exact any funds from non-members, unquote, in the event of a dues increase absent consent. So this is a situation where if there's a mid-year special assessment or dues increase, none of that money can be collected from a non-member, in the usual situation where they could collect only the percentage they expect to spend on collective bargaining activities. Now they can collect none of it. So the main objection of the dissenting and concurring judges, which is that this decision went much farther than it needed to in order to answer the questions presented, and that it went farther than even the parties requested, I think has some resonance. That said, there's a couple of other points from my devil's advocate perspective that I would make on the merits. And the main one is, and Justice Breyer talked quite a bit about this in his dissent, is that on the facts of this case, it's not clear at all that the union members, the non-members were actually subsidizing union political speech at all. The facts are, to sort of summarize them briefly, the previous year, before this special assessment, 56% of the union's spending had been on chargeable activities. Jim, you can correct me if I bollocks up any of these figures. And so in 2005, when the union issued a notice for the following year, they informed non-members of that percentage, and they said, if you object, you only have to pay 56% of the union dues. So in the middle of this year, they do this special assessment. They do spend quite a bit of it for non-chargeable political activity. But at the end of the year, when they did their, when they totaled up the numbers and figured out what percentage of the money they collected from non-members had been spent on chargeable activity, the number turned out to be 69%. In other words, if you take the entire year's spending and don't separate out the special assessment, the union actually spent a higher percentage of its collections on chargeable collective bargaining activities, activities that they are allowed under the Constitution to charge non-members for, than they had the year before. And the upshot of that fact is that if you don't, If you don't look at this through the narrow lens of just focusing on this particular expenditure, but you look at it, as Hudson suggested you should, through the lens of the entire year, the union, the non-members actually paid less than their share for collective bargaining activities, and they didn't subsidize the union's political spending at all. And that's the position the dissent adopts, and the one that the respondents in this case took, which is that, look, money is fungible. There's absolutely no reason to focus in narrowly on this particular bucket of money. You look at the entire year. You use the sensible Hudson approach of allowing the union to calculate its dues and its chargeable and non-chargeable amounts based on the previous year's figures. Anything else will cause chaos and lawsuits and disruptions. And looked at from that perspective, there was not only no constitutional violation here, but quite the opposite. No attempt whatsoever to get non-members to engage in subsidization of the union's political speech to any larger degree than in any other case. And so I think when the dissent, for that reason and the fact that Justice Alito hinted so broadly at his willingness to revisit past opinions, I think the dissent is correct to note that it appears that the court's door is open to reconsider fundamental pieces of the Hudson scheme, not just the narrow question resolved here, which is the opt-in scheme with respect to mid-year assessments. And at that, I would turn it back to Jim.
Well, thanks, Dom. I wouldn't correct you on the facts. You seem to have gotten them all correct, and I appreciate your comments. And there is, and I would have to concede, there is some justification for the dissent's conclusion. The language is broad, and the Justice Alito's majority opinion, I think it does signal a willingness to reconsider some basic motherhoods that became motherhoods without really a great deal of consideration by the earlier court. I think Justice Alito described the whole opt-in versus opt-out scheme as an historical anomaly, and quite frankly a factual anomaly that was imported from a case where it was initially used involving both members. Demonstrated an indicia of support for the union agenda, and therefore dissent probably shouldn't be presumed. But non-members have the question that really arises for non-members is, why should consent be presumed? And as to the fungibility argument, I guess the question is one of the old cross-examination questions: were you lying then or were you lying now? The union said at the outset, at the very outset, we're spending this on politics. We're not spending it as we normally do. Basically suggesting that they would be these funds would be segregated. And then certainly that's the presumption upon which they adopted the assessment. The presumption upon which they notified their members and non-members alike that they would be proceeding, and it was only after being hailed into court that suddenly we heard that some of these funds would in fact be chargeable. So, I would have to concede that the notion that opt-out was not necessarily before the court on this occasion opt-in versus opt-out was not before the court is well taken. But of course, you deal with the issue of remedy, and you deal with what Judge England and how he will administer the remedies that he ordered below. And I certainly think there is some legitimacy in the comments in Justice Alito's conclusion that providing guidance to the lower courts in this regard would be whether it would be appropriate. But the ultimate question on the issue of fungibility of funds and this whole temporary suspension is whether the union is to be taken at its word at the outset. As for the
concern expressed in many of the commentators already regarding this case that it would cause chaos, lawsuits, and disruptions. Well, that's a song, frankly, we've heard for decades, and it seems to me from the union side. First of all, the union the court reaffirmed some of the comments have crowed about the fact the court reaffirmed the fact that unions can force people to who are non-members to subsidize some of their activities. Well, that's all well and good, but it wasn't. That also was an issue that really wasn't before the court. It's conceded. It's been conceded throughout the litigation. The questions here were twofold. How does the union procedurally protect the First Amendment rights of the non-members? And second, whether in this case the expenditures the union made to fight one of these ballot propositions on the theory that it was necessary to protect their contractual rights, electoral activities were properly chargeable to non-members. And as to that question, neither one of us really addressed at the outset, the court was quite clear that no, electoral activities, ballot initiatives, fighting ballot initiatives, no matter their purpose, was strictly non-chargeable under the court's precedence. I'll throw it back to you, Dean, and maybe sir rebuttal from my friend Dom.
Well, we could go to audience questions now. Dom, do you have something you want to say in response to
that? Let me make one more point just to tee up this issue for the audience. Jim, you raised the idea that, you know, look, this is a new special assessment where the union has come right out and said, we are going to spend this money on political electioneering and other political expenditures. And that makes a difference. This is what our side of the case argued throughout the litigation. But I think that the response has some force, the response offered by the dissent in this case and by the union. And that response is this. That's just an arbitrary line. If you looked at every expenditure that a union makes over the course of any year, even a year where there is no special assessment, and looked at it individually, you'd have the union saying with respect to one expenditure, hey, this expenditure is political. The next one might be non-political. The third one would be, in fact, political. So if you look at it from that perspective, you would get into a situation where union members have the right to object on a expenditure basis throughout the year. But the court put that to bed a long time ago. The court decided in Hudson that's not how we view things. We view things from the perspective of the year before. It's the most easily administrable system. We're not going to go through expenditure by expenditure. We're going to cover this on a annual basis, and the money will come out in the wash. So it's pretty clear that the approach taken by the court here, unsettles what was a settled area of law.
I would have a lot less to do if it were as settled as we sometimes we wish it were. But I think Justice Alito addressed that in his final footnote. And the last paragraph, the extraordinary nature of this case. In fact, I thought that, and I was surprised we didn't see it in the, opposition or a cert petition. The fact that it is a unique case. The procedures that must be followed when it's a special assessment or a mid-year dues increase. Hasn't been litigated to a great degree. There was this case and there was another case handled by a colleague. NEA's responded. It was a lesser assessment regarding NEA's response to these ballot initiatives in 2005. And Justice Breyer's very last sentence of that very last footnote, no prior decision of this court has addressed that question, and Hudson says not one word on the subject. Pretty effective response, I think. But I agree that it's a legitimate concern. But the unique nature of this assessment, I think, is, and of course we can only speculate, what caught the attention of the court and caused them to, take a hard look at some of the underlying theoretical bases for forced unionism schemes.
Okay, gentlemen, there's a lot on the table. Let's turn to our audience now. To our audience now and see what's on their minds today. We have well over 100 people on the call, so let's open the floor to their questions. Let's go to that first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's examine some of the ways in which Hudson might be reexamined and perhaps overturned. One approach that I'd ask you to consider is to challenge the jurisdiction of federal courts in cases where the contracting parties, namely the union and the individual worker, are residents of the same state. That would seem to divest it of diversity jurisdiction and open one approach to challenging court federal jurisdiction in such cases.
I guess I'll take that one, Dom, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Since I wrote the jurisdictional statement and the complaint, these cases aren't based on diversity jurisdiction. These are federal question jurisdiction, and therefore that's why we're in federal court. And quite frankly, that's where we prefer to be to litigate these claims. I hope that addresses your question.
What about other approaches to overturning Hudson?
Well, Hudson's the law. I mean, Hudson is a Supreme Court decision binding on all the lower federal and state courts, and state labor boards. We've litigated some cases there. As far as overturning Hudson, Hudson is what we've characterized as a First Amendment due process decision, and is at least I'm not sure what we would particularly want to overturn, since it is something that protects the rights. So the real problem, of course, is Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, a 1977 case litigated by my foundation colleagues. Of course, I was in middle school, and in that case, the Supreme Court upheld the public sector agency shop, public sector forced unionism schemes. Now, I think there's good cause to believe that the majority in this case may be willing to revisit that question, but it's a long road to hoe to get a case to the Supreme Court, and it would have to be a case that was had good facts. I think one of the reasons we met with success here is the fact that we had good facts.
Let me add to that. This is Dom Perella speaking. You know, I think part of the question was just aimed at the idea of how do we take advantage, and I should say how does Jim take advantage, since he's the repeat player in this field, of the openings that were created by Justice Alito in this majority opinion. And I think the answer to that is fairly straightforward. Justice Alito drops broad hints that opt-out regimes are not permissible in any circumstances. That he didn't answer that question because he couldn't reach it given the facts here. But it seems that in another case where there's an opt-out regime, in other words, where non-members are being held as a default to pay for all of the union's expenses and can only get out of paying the political piece by affirmatively lodging an objection. It seems clear that those sorts of schemes are at play in the wake of Justice Alito's opinion. And so a case presenting the right facts could argue that the opt-out regime is unconstitutional, and given the opinion yesterday, and assuming the constitution of the court stays the same, you would think that that claim would have a good chance of success.
I wouldn't disagree with you, my friend. This is Jim Young.
Okay, quite a few more questions from our audience. Let's go to the next caller.
John Jumper, one of the named plaintiffs on this case. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Can I make a couple of comments as opposed to questions?
Go right ahead.
First of all, the comment that, and this was brought up in the arguments, was because this is fungible and because Hudson says you will look at last year's funds and make a decision on how much is going to be chargeable for this year and the next year and yada, 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 the problem that we had as non-members is we've asked the union for years now to open their books to let somebody else see if the numbers that they're telling us is accurate. So that particular year they said 56% of payments were non-chargeable, were chargeable, and so we can collect 56% of our union dues for chargeable expenses. And we said, well, how do we know your 56% is accurate? They've never, ever let anybody look at their books to see that 56% or 72% or 27% is accurate. That's the first major problem with that particular argument. The other concern that we had is many of us, and I have, ever since I have been I call myself a forced share member, forced to pay into their dues, ever since that has been the case, I have been following the Hudson notice, sending my non-germane request letter on before June 30th every year, and so I have had the reduced fees. When the union made this special assessment, we said, wait a minute, I'm a non-germane objector. How come you're still making me pay this? I'm not having anything to do with political speech. The union says, sorry. And that's why Diane Knox and the rest of us said, sign on a piece of paper, let's fight these suckers.
Well, I guess I'll go first this time. I think that, you know, the way the union handled, this is Don Perella, the way the union handled the special assessment was one of the, you know, to the extent the facts mattered here, it was one of the motivating factors that got the court to come out the way it did. And in fact, even the concurring justices, Sotomayor and Ginsburg, concurred in the judgment, as everyone saw. And they did so on that basis. They said, look, you know, we don't agree with the rationale of the majority opinion here, but we agree that non-members had to be given the chance to opt out of this new assessment, which is why the decision was 7-2 and not 5-4. On the books question, and Jim, you should correct me on this one if I'm wrong because you have more experience in this area, but I was under the impression that that's kind of a separate Hudson problem. If the union isn't allowing people into its books and is not agreeing to some sort of audit or whatever the case might be before the fee is assessed, that is a separate Hudson claim that doesn't necessarily go to the question of whether an opt-in or an opt-out regime is appropriate.
Understood.
You're correct, Dom. This is Jim Young. You're correct. There is in Hudson a level of accountability. It involves, appropriately enough, accountants, in the requirement that the union provide notice and disclosure, and the financial disclosure is subject to verification by an independent auditor. Now, there are all levels of audits a level of detail we don't need to get into, but essentially the accountants with varying degrees of scrutiny, frankly, will audit the union's books to determine whether or not there is the union's books support that percentage. And in our experience, greater and lesser degree, there are greater and lesser degrees of accuracy in that. There is a distinction between what we call notice challenges, and that's what this case was, and chargeability challenges, that is, putting the union to its proofs that the percentage that it claims is chargeable is actually chargeable. And in those cases are a quantum, an order of magnitude degree more complicated than a notice challenge, and consequently more expensive to litigate, and we are a charitable organization. But when we have litigated that issue in a number of cases, including a Leonard case, a case that went to the Supreme Court in 1991 and was litigated by by our now legal director, Ray Lajeunesse, and the Beck case a few years earlier, also went to the Supreme Court, private sector case. Leonard was a public sector case. The union's claims of chargeability were grotesquely inflated. In fact, in Leonard, the union could prove that less than 10% of its expenditures were for collective bargaining purposes. That is 90% non-chargeable. In Beck, it was somewhere around 21%, I believe, for a private sector union. There are two separate issues there, this case, at least as we initially litigated it, as we have litigated it, is strictly a notice challenge case.
Okay, we've got quite a few more people lined up with questions. Let's go to the next one.
Hi, this is Robert Fried with Atkinson Annelson in California, and I know this is a public sector case, but a certain amount of abounded curiosity exists because of the expansive language of the opinion. So if anyone is willing to venture a crystal ball, please comment on where this case might be used in private sector litigation.
I think that's probably for me, Dom.
It is.
This is Jim Young again. Obviously, the logic that the court raises is hopefully transportable, but we are talking there's a large distinction, as you're probably aware, Robert, between cases where there are where there is state action, which there is in the public sector cases, of course. Public states authorize, enforce, and agree to agency shop agreements, and the National Labor Relations Act, which is two private actors agreeing to a collective bargaining agreement. Absent the state action, the more exacting scrutiny required under the First Amendment has been held in a number of cases, mostly before the National Labor Relations Board, to not be applicable and not fully transferable. Under the Railway Labor Act, which governs the rail and airline industries, there has been state action found, and hence the logic of this decision will probably be completely applicable as we address situations as they present themselves in those industries.
Well, thank you. That's an excellent answer. Working in California, and by the way, I was amicus counsel in Chamber versus Brown.
Hmm.
Working in California, where the state of California has a tendency to stick its regulatory into all manner of things, our prevailing wage system includes provisions for all of the labor agreement details to be included in prevailing wage and other things. I think our radar is up on the state action question, so your thoughts are much appreciated.
Well, thank you. Glad to help out.
Look, we have two more people with questions. Then to the next question.
Hi, it's Mike Eastman at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We had the same question, so rather than use up more time on that, we'll pass the baton and just say congratulations, guys.
Thank you.
Okay. At this point, we have one more question.
Gentlemen, this is Matthew McReynolds from Pacific Justice Institute. Thanks, first of all, for a great and very timely discussion, and congratulations to Jim. My question relates to maybe more of a practical aspect of the chargeable and non-chargeable expenses that may or may not be directly related to the opinion yesterday, but has kind of been raised by some of the prior callers and commentary. We at Pacific Justice Institute have quite a number of people that contact us wanting to get out of their unions, and there seem to be they seem to often struggle with whether to go the agency fee payer route or whether to assert a religious objector route. And a lot of that relates to uncertainty over whether all of a union's objectionable activities are being classified as non-chargeable expenses. So my question is probably for Jim, whether in the course of this litigation or perhaps in other litigation related to it, have you come across any indication that these large labor unions may be classifying expenses related to some of the hot-button social issues of the day, like, for instance, legal briefs filed in some of the same-sex marriage cases as chargeable expenses? Any indication that maybe they're doing some of that?
I will take that one. Obviously, this is Jim Young, and thanks for the question, Matthew. As I implied earlier, we don't do a great deal of the spending cases simply because of the great expense involved, and frankly, the fact that and I do probably more public sector litigation than most of my colleagues, due to the fact that, quite honestly, there's still a lot of unions still not complying with Hudson 26 years after. I mean, I was graduating from college about the time it was decided. It's been 26 years, and there's I've sued a union twice in the last 3 years, the same union in Pennsylvania, because it refuses to comply with Hudson. To ask whether or not we've come across evidence that they're charging for those activities, I can't say that we have. But to a broader issue, certainly the unions do engage in activities in bargaining that might conflict with an individual's sincerely held religious beliefs. For instance, we have a case, Professor Robert Resser at the University of Detroit from years ago, had a religious objection to the NEA's support for abortion rights, reproductive rights, if you want to talk about whatever, however you want to categorize them. But the NEA, what he perceived to be, I think accurately, the NEA's pro-abortion rights stance. And interestingly, the University of Detroit is, by the way, a Jesuit institution, I believe, certainly Catholic. And so he didn't want any of his money going to the NEA. And I believe that his right to divert that, pursuant to his deeply held and sincerely held religious beliefs, was upheld, although that is not my area of expertise. Unfortunately, my colleague Bruce Cameron is not here today. He may be listening. The individuals, the reasonable accommodations that are required under Title VII are distinct from the First and 14th Amendment rights as they have developed under the Abood and Hudson regimes. I think in some ways religious objectors have different alternatives to address these issues.
Very good. We've got, for now, what looks to be our last question.
Hi, this is Deborah Lefebvre at Pacific Legal Foundation. Thank you very much for the shout-out during your remarks, Jim. Appreciate that. And I'm just so excited and want to congratulate you again on this tremendous victory for the First Amendment. It's just great.
Congratulate both of us, Deborah, because Dom had a big part in it, too.
Congratulations, Dom.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And to you.
I've been at PLF for a long time, and after we won the Keller case, which was a compelled speech case, I then spent the next 10 years of my life trying to enforce it. And so I'm wondering, what's next, both for your Knox plaintiffs and for any other cases you have in the pipeline to make sure that this sticks, because, you know, as you or one of the other callers mentioned, you know, the unions never cooperate with these things, and so you're constantly dragging them into court. You know, so do you have like a strategic plan for holding their feet to the fire?
Well, I wouldn't want to speak out of school, but we're discussing. I mean, the foundation has been around since 1968, Deborah, as you probably are aware, and you know, neither we nor unions, quite frankly, notwithstanding the gnashing of teeth that goes on with things occurring in Wisconsin, and now this case. I think somebody described it as, I think the American Prospect described it as the court's Scott Walker moment, if I'm not mistaken. What's next? Yeah, we will have to enforce it, and we're not going anywhere. Unions aren't going anywhere. As far as I know, unions aren't disclaiming the moral authority to force people to subsidize their activities. Which is an interesting comment on both morality and their confidence in their ability to persuade people that they are useful institutions. But they're not going anywhere. We're not going anywhere. And at this point, you know, aside from basking in the glow of having won a decision, which is wonderful, It's an interesting decision, which raises lots of interesting issues, and you know, we've got a brain trust here at the foundation that I've been proud to be a part of for more than two decades now, and we will be discussing these implications. We will be mapping out strategies, and I suspect that over the next few months, days, weeks, we'll be receiving calls from people who, some of whom may have been told they had to be union members, which hasn't been the law since 1947, in the private sector in any case. We'll be receiving calls from public sector employees who, like those in Wisconsin, who once they were freed from the obligation to pay union dues, at least those represented by AFSCME, I mean, more than half voted with their feet.
Right.
And I would just add, I mean, and maybe Jim, I'll change roles here and be a questioner for a moment. The actual holding of this case only applies to special assessments and mid-year dues increases. So in terms of holding union's feet to the fire, I don't know how often that comes up as a practical matter. But it strikes me that the bigger and more long-term challenge would be to get an opt-in regime adopted across the board, at which point, obviously, holding unions' feet to the fire would become something that's necessary with respect to every union, and not just to these occasional mid-year increase cases.
Well, Dom, it's been my devout hope for more than 20 years to do that, and I ain't going anywhere either, as far as I know. At least my doctor hasn't told me. So, I don't want to tip our hand as to strategy. But, you know, the foundation will continue to fight for the rights of individuals against this type of thing. And one of the luxuries of my practice is I really have two. I get to work with a bunch of great, very smart people. In this case, I just happen to be the one that gets to stand up and take a little of the glory. But I also have the luxury of picking cases I think I can win. And I'm pretty sure, having read Justice Alito's decision, that universe may have expanded.
That's great news.
Well, thanks,
Deborah,
for the
question. Looks like we do have another question from our call-in audience.
Actually, it's not a question but a comment. This is Ray Lajeunesse, Jim's boss, legal director at the National Right to Work Foundation.
I agree with everything you have to say, Ray.
I just wanted to add that Justice Alito, in his opinion, points out the problem with the dissent's assumption that the regular scheme of things, regardless of what the percentages are in the annual Hudson notices, protects First Amendment rights. And that is, he points out, Justice Alito does in his opinion, that you assume that the dissent is assuming that the union's allocation of expenses as chargeable or not is correct as a matter of law. And the audit doesn't solve that problem, Alito points out, because the auditor takes as given the union's legal determinations as to what is chargeable or not, and merely looks at whether they spent the money in the way they said they did. So as a result, if the union says that political lobbying, as this union did here, is lawfully chargeable, the auditor affirms that. And so what happens is, what happened in this case, is that monies were taken from non-members, spent on politics, violating their First Amendment rights, and was only given to them after the fact if they objected in the next year.
And Ray is exactly correct. I'm not just agreeing to be a lickspittle here. Ray is exactly correct. In fact, some of the lower courts, when we have challenged the role of the auditor, have made the comment. Like what's taxable and non-taxable, what's deductible and non-deductible. Well, aside from that, that's what courts have said in this context. So he's exactly correct. The whole notion that there's veracity in the legality in the union's later audit for the year in which the money was expended is not necessarily a presumption that the court is entitled to make.
And if I could add another comment, if I'm still open,
you are open, Mike. Ray, please go right ahead.
The earlier questioner, one of the earlier questioners, asked about the application of this to the private sector, and Jim pointed out that there is a difference between the public and private sector in the sense that the agreements in the private sector are made between two private parties. However, the Supreme Court in our Beck case did say that there is an open question as to whether there's state action under the National Labor Relations Act because, obviously, the right to enter into that forced unionism agreement is authorized in the National Labor Relations Act. And the whole situation, from our standpoint, is that the union is in no position to force people to pay fees unless they have exclusive representation or what we call monopoly bargaining, which is established by the federal statute. And the courts of appeals are split as to whether that's state action. So it's an open question, which needs to be decided by the Supreme Court in the subsequent case.
Very good. Well, gentlemen, it looks like we've exhausted the questions from the audience. Before we go, I do want to give each of you a chance to express any final thoughts you might have. Mr. Perella, you want to go first?
Well, not to shorten the call, but I believe I've said everything I was interested in saying. At this point, I would just congratulate Jim on his victory.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Dom, and you were a big part of it. I want to thank the Federal Society for the opportunity to speak on these issues and to acknowledge the role of others. Success does have 1,000 fathers, and I am grateful for all of them. As I said, I'm just the one who was privileged to stand up a little nervous and start out, Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, and in this case, at least, have what appears to be a truly outstanding victory and outstanding opinion from the court. We're quite pleased here.
Terrific. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Mr. Young and Mr. Perella for joining us today, and acknowledge that Mr. Perella was filling the shoes of the opposing or dissenting voice, so I appreciate you playing that role as well, and our congratulations to Mr. Young as well. But also thank you to the audience for dialing in and for your questions today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.